This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's a reason we keep talking about Jeffrey Dahmer. It's not just morbid curiosity, though there's plenty of that to go around. No, it's because Dahmer represents something deeply unsettling. He wasn't born in shadows, hidden away like a monster from the start. No, he was a child, out in the open, sending warning signals clear enough for anyone paying attention. But back then, who really was? Recent analyses have started to reframe how we look at Dahmer psychologically. While most people assume serial killers like Dahmer fit neatly into a box labeled psychopath, recent psychiatric experts suggest otherwise. Some argue Dahmer's psyche was rooted less in cold psychopathy and more in something psychiatrists today might label borderline personality disorder, characterized by an intense fear of abandonment, emotional volatility, and unstable relationships. Those who've studied his case closely point out Dahmer displayed certain behaviors suggesting that he wasn't a cold-hearted sociopath, but rather a deeply disturbed individual plagued by abandonment fears and unstable emotional attachments. Of course, none of this understanding existed back when Jeffrey Dahmer was a kid. In the 1960s, if you had emotional problems, they were either hushed up or explained away. Family struggled quietly behind the neat picket fences of suburban America, and the Dahmers were no exception. Jeffrey Dahmer was born in Milwaukee in 1960 to Lionel and Joyce Dahmer. Lionel was a bright chemist who dreamed big dreams but was frequently away at work, chasing career advancement and personal achievements. Joyce, meanwhile, Joyce was deeply troubled. Hypochondria, anxiety, and severe depression defined her days, and frequent bitter fights filled their home. Family friends later described the Dahmer household as the sort of place you might visit once, then politely decline to return to. Something always tense simmering just below the surface, like an unpleasant dinner party that never ended. By the time Jeffrey was a toddler, his parents' marriage had become a constant battleground. Arguments and near-divorce attempts shook the boy's world, leaving him feeling perpetually uncertain of his family's stability. At a time when most children develop security from warm embraces, bedtime stories, and routine, young Jeffrey experienced chaos. Imagine growing up on a stormy sea. You might survive it, but you'd always feel a little seasick. This was Jeffrey's childhood, unstable, uncertain, and unpredictable. Then came the double hernia surgery just before Jeffrey's fourth birthday. A fairly common procedure, sure, thousands of kids have similar surgeries every year without major complications. But for Jeffrey, it seems something fundamentally changed. Lionel and Joyce Dahmer noticed it immediately. Before surgery, Jeffrey had been an energetic, talkative boy, playful, and outgoing. Afterward, he withdrew, noticeably quiet, oddly reserved. A kid who once bounced around the house happily now shrank into the shadows, watching life pass by from a distance. It was almost as if some invisible switch had been flipped, dimming his light permanently. Experts looking back now suggest this trauma may have deeply impacted him emotionally, contributing to a lifelong struggle with intimacy, trust, and normal human attachment. By the mid-1960s, the Dahmer family moved repeatedly, finally settling in Bath, Ohio. For Jeffrey, each relocation intensified his isolation. Always the new kid, always awkwardly silent, Jeffrey didn't just struggle to make friends, he stopped trying altogether. He faded into the background, invisible like wallpaper, and no one really minded. Around this same time, something else was brewing in young Jeffrey's mind, a fixation with death that quickly spiraled into disturbing obsessions. At age four, Jeffrey watched his father Lionel pulling animal bones out from under their porch. Most four-year-olds would find such a sight unsettling, disgusting even. But Jeffrey described later that he was thrilled. An oddly joyful reaction, according to his father. Lionel, a chemist by profession and a father desperately searching for common ground, encouraged this odd hobby, believing he was fostering a scientific curiosity. It was the 1960s, after all. Science was king. Astronauts walked on the moon. Why not encourage a little biology at home? Well, Lionel soon discovered Why not? His lessons on bleaching and preserving bones were eagerly consumed by Jeffrey, but this hobby quickly went beyond innocent scientific curiosity. Roadkill became Jeffrey's treasures. Dead squirrels, raccoons, and possums collected, like other kids collected baseball cards. His backyard shed became a private laboratory. His sanctuary, really. This wasn't just biology experiments anymore. It was morbid fascination disguised as science homework. Jeffrey meticulously dissected animals, placing their cleaned skulls into jars of formaldehyde, as if building some macabre museum that only he understood. But the warning signs didn't stop there. In one unforgettable incident, Jeffrey mounted a dog's severed head on a stake behind his home. Imagine that, a teenager casually planting a dog's skull on display like some gruesome lawn ornament, then brushing it off as nothing more than a harmless prank when confronted. And people bought it, or at least they pretended to. Back then, folks liked to believe teenagers were mischievous, not monsters in training. A convenient blind eye. School life mirrored home life. Jeffrey's classmates saw him as the odd loner type, not threatening per se, but definitely strange. He quickly developed a reputation for drinking in school. By his early teens, he was openly carrying bottles of alcohol to class, drinking daily in broad daylight. Teachers noticed but seemed ill-equipped to intervene effectively. There were no counselors trained to spot the red flags of violent tendencies, no intervention programs, no awareness that teenage alcoholism might mask darker impulses. Dahmer slipped through the cracks of a well-intentioned but clueless education system. Again and again, signs appeared. Alcohol abuse, animal cruelty, social withdrawal, and yet no alarms were sounded, no red flags raised. To complicate things further, Dahmer was dealing internally with sexuality and identity at a time when these were simply not discussed openly, especially not in suburban Ohio. He knew early on he was gay, a realization which only deepened his isolation. Instead of seeking comfort or guidance, Jeffrey began developing fantasies, dark fantasies of domination, of controlling another person completely. These were not innocent teenage dreams of romance. They involved imagining himself with someone unconscious, submissive, completely under his control. And disturbingly, those fantasies soon became active plans. At 16, Jeffrey decided to act. He hid in bushes near his home, holding a baseball bat, waiting to ambush a local jogger he had become fixated upon. Thankfully, the jogger never passed by that day. Luck saved a life, at least temporarily. But that incident should have sounded alarms in Jeffrey's head and in the minds of anyone who might have been watching closely. Unfortunately, no one was. This dangerous mix of isolation, disturbing fantasies, and a childhood consumed by chaos, neglect, and abandonment, fears began spiraling toward disaster. It was the 1970s, and psychological red flags like animal cruelty, morbid obsessions, and violent fantasies weren't part of society's vocabulary. No one, not teachers, parents, counselors, or police, were prepared to interpret or even recognize these signs. Even Jeffrey himself seemed quietly terrified by what was growing inside him, but without an outlet or intervention, the darkness festered. Experts now recognize that early intervention can prevent troubled kids from becoming violent adults. But back then, the psychological profession was still primitive compared to today's standards. Dahmer's strange behaviors, his bone collecting, his unsettling fascination with anatomy, his emotional detachment, were written off as awkward eccentricities, mere oddities, rather than clear precursors to violence. Society simply didn't know enough to connect the dots, leaving Jeffrey Dahmer free to spiral deeper into darkness, his troubled mind like a storm left to brew in isolation. Yet it would be unfair and far too simple to blame his family alone. Lionel and Joyce Dahmer were ill-equipped, burdened by their own emotional struggles, and living in an era where parenting a troubled child meant muddling through blindly. Jeffrey's mother's depression and his father's career-driven absences created an emotional void. Yes, but many families face such struggles without tragic outcomes. What set Dahmer apart was the unique cocktail of isolation, emotional neglect, deviant obsessions, and a world blind to mental health and its consequences. It was a disastrous recipe, simmering unnoticed. So as Jeffrey Dahmer reached adulthood, he was already carrying inside him all the troubling signs that could and should have been caught. The warning bells had rung loudly through childhood and adolescence, yet no one stopped to listen. No one looked closely enough to see the monster forming before their eyes. And with every missed signal, Dahmer was inching closer to tragedy, his internal struggles growing darker and more dangerous. And soon enough, the young man with a quiet obsession for bones would leave animal remains behind. He would move on to something far more terrifying, something truly monstrous, proving once again that the signs you overlook are often the ones most dangerous. If someone handed you the script of what happened on May 27th, 1991, you'd dismiss it as unbelievable fiction, a plot too absurd even for television. Yet reality often outpaces imagination, especially when Jeffrey Dahmer is involved. On that warm May evening, 14-year-old Conorak Synthesomphone stumbled into the streets of Milwaukee, dazed, disoriented, and desperate for help. He was naked, visibly injured, and incoherent. Clearly, he needed assistance. Several concerned neighbors rushed to help the boy, quickly calling police. Officers arrived promptly, but what followed was an episode of police work so staggeringly incompetent, you'd swear someone was making it up to mock authority. Tragically, it was all too real. Within moments, Dahmer appeared at the scene, calm, composed, disturbingly confident. He approached the responding officers with an easy smile, weaving a grotesque tale so effortlessly it should have raised alarms immediately. Dahmer told the police that Conorak was his 19-year-old boyfriend who'd merely had too much to drink after an argument. Conorak was neither 19 nor Dahmer's boyfriend, of course. He was a terrified, drugged child bleeding from visible wounds. Neighbors on the scene were incredulous, pleading with the officers to intervene. One woman insisted Conorak was clearly just a boy and badly hurt. But the police saw something else entirely. An uncomfortable domestic dispute between two gay men? To them, it was something they'd rather not deal with. They dismissed the neighbors' pleas. Dahmer reassured the officers calmly, confidently. He explained away Conorak's confusion as drunkenness, even joking with the police as though they were casual acquaintances. Shockingly, the officers believed him. In an act of catastrophic negligence, they escorted Conorak, a terrified child, back to Dahmer's apartment, right back into the hands of his predator. Inside Dahmer's apartment, a few half-hearted glances around the place revealed little to the indifferent officers. They noted a strange smell, rotting flesh that Dahmer casually explained as bad meat and some exotic fish. They didn't check his bedroom, nor did they dig deeper. Perhaps it was sheer laziness or simply the unsettling discomfort of the moment. But there's another, darker reality. Their biases blinded them. After leaving the apartment, the officers even joked on their radio about needing to be deloused, laughing off the incident as some sordid affair they'd thankfully dodged. Meanwhile, mere minutes after the police left, Conorak was dead, murdered by Dahmer with chilling ease. If it wasn't real, you might laugh at such incompetence, but tragically, this was deadly reality. This catastrophic mistake wasn't an isolated incident. It was just the loudest, most shocking alarm bell among many. Dahmer's crime spanned more than a decade, right under the noses of those tasked with stopping him. Time and again, authorities overlooked obvious signs, discounted warnings, and shrugged off clear evidence pointing to something terribly wrong. Neighbors around Dahmer's apartment complex repeatedly reported strange odors, late-night drilling sounds, and unusual noises coming from his apartment. One neighbor, Glenda Cleveland, made multiple attempts to alert authorities. She witnessed the aftermath of the Conorak incident and persistently called police to follow up. She knew something horrific was happening in apartment 213, and yet, time and again, her warnings were ignored, her concerns brushed aside by officials who trusted Dahmer, a clean-cut, articulate white man, over her urgent pleas. It's a twisted irony that authorities believed the charming monster rather than a concerned citizen desperately trying to prevent further tragedy. But why were such clear, obvious warnings disregarded? Here's where the ugly undercurrent of society comes into sharp relief. Dahmer preyed on marginalized young men, often people of color, many involved in Milwaukee's gay bar scene. In a city struggling with race relations and widespread homophobia, these were victims easily overlooked by those charged with protecting them. It wasn't that these young men weren't missed by their families, they were. But when families reported their loved ones missing, authorities were indifferent at best. Officers frequently assumed young men of color simply ran away or chose an alternative lifestyle that meant they'd likely return eventually. Victims were not treated seriously because of who they were and how they lived their lives. Dahmer knew exactly how to exploit these societal blind spots. The biases in Dahmer's Milwaukee weren't exactly subtle. Police openly joked about situations involving gay men, casually reinforcing harmful stereotypes. Following the Conorak incident, the two officers involved were recorded on police radio joking crudely, even remarking that they would need to be deloused, a clear nod to bigoted assumptions linking homosexuality with disease. Prejudice wasn't hidden in shadows. It was flaunted carelessly over airwaves. But beyond the biases within individual officers, the broader systemic failures were equally glaring. The police didn't act alone in their blindness. Institutions across the board seemed oblivious. Courts, probation officers, counselors, they all held fragments of Dahmer's troubled history, but failed to piece them together into the horrific puzzle Dahmer ultimately became. In 1988, 3 years before Dahmer's ultimate capture, he had already been convicted of molesting a 13-year-old boy. You'd assume that such a serious crime might have put him firmly under watch. But Dahmer's punishment was disturbingly lenient, 1 year of work release and probation. He served only 10 months. He attended court-ordered counseling sessions and regularly reported to his probation officer. But nothing meaningful was ever done to address Dahmer's disturbing psychological issues. It was as though they opened his file, glanced at it casually, and promptly forgot what was inside. Jeffrey Dahmer walked out of jail not rehabilitated, just emboldened. This probation oversight is almost darkly comedic if it weren't painfully real. Dahmer was actively killing and dismembering victims even as he regularly checked in with his probation officer. Authorities had access to his past, his behavior patterns, even knowledge of his fascination with dead animals, sexual aggression, and troubling personal instability. Yet no one connected those dots, and Dahmer's red flags became invisible once again. When you zoom out, it's astonishing to see just how consistently institutions failed Dahmer's victims. School systems had noted his drinking problems but didn't act. Neighbors pleaded with police but were ignored. Probation officers glanced casually at red flags screaming from Dahmer's file and shrugged them off. Society itself looked the other way, preferring not to see troubling behaviors that challenge their comfort zones around race, sexuality, and poverty. But perhaps the most unsettling realization is how Dahmer himself understood and exploited these biases. He preyed precisely on those he thought society would ignore. He used homophobia and racism like camouflage, knowing that if his victims were young white women from upscale suburbs, authorities would have been relentless in their pursuit. Instead, by carefully choosing marginalized victims, he bought himself time, space, and frighteningly, legitimacy in the eyes of indifferent officials. What makes this institutional blindness so horrifying is not just the specific failures of individuals, but the broader culture that allowed these failures to occur. The late 80s and early 90s were not exactly shining eras of progressive thought, especially not in police departments of Midwestern cities. Milwaukee's police force at the time wasn't uniquely incompetent. Rather, it reflected widely held biases of its era. It took Dahmer's monstrous acts being uncovered for the city and indeed the nation to finally see clearly what it had so determinedly ignored. Reflecting on these tragic mistakes, one thing becomes chillingly clear. Jeffrey Dahmer didn't slip through the cracks. The cracks themselves were enormous, gaping holes created by prejudice, negligence, and a systemic refusal to take warning signs seriously. As we revisit these grim lessons decades later, it begs a deeply uncomfortable question. Have we truly learned anything, or are these cracks still quietly waiting, ready to swallow the next warning whole? You know, we'd all like to think that after the shockwaves of Dahmer's nightmare, after the endless documentaries, books, podcasts, and even TV dramas, that somehow we've become wiser. We'd love to believe our eyes are sharper, our senses keener, and our collective radar finely tuned to catch monsters before they strike. And yet, as comforting as that notion is, reality loves to disappoint. Consider Stephen Port, a name you might not know as well as Dahmer's, though the parallels are chillingly similar. From 2014 to 2015 in London, Port quietly targeted young men, luring them through dating apps, drugging them, and disposing of their bodies near his home. 4 young men all found dead within a few hundred yards of Port's apartment. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And once again, the police response was staggeringly inadequate. Authorities initially dismissed the deaths as overdoses or suicides, labeling them tragic but unrelated accidents. Families pleaded, begged for answers, for basic detective work. It fell largely on deaf ears. It took 4 bodies, 4 lives lost, before London police finally admitted they had a serial killer on their hands. So much for modern vigilance. We've seen this movie before, yet here it was again, playing out in real time in a world supposedly changed by the lessons learned from Jeffrey Dahmer. We were smarter, right? More aware? Apparently, not enough. Since Dahmer's era, psychology has made leaps and bounds, or so we're frequently reminded. Today, early warning signs, animal cruelty, extreme isolation, disturbing sexual fantasies, are familiar enough for concerned parents, teachers, and even teens themselves to recognize. We're saturated by psychology textbooks, podcasts, and true crime series, each screaming the signs clearly enough that you'd think spotting dangerous behavior would now be second nature. And yet, when someone shows those very behaviors, we still hesitate. Often, they're shrugged off as awkwardness or simple teenage rebellion. We still say things like, he's just a strange kid. Give him some space, and she'll grow out of it, won't she? We've got Netflix documentaries on serial killers and stacks of psych textbooks taller than our heads, yet we're still waiting until something happens, until someone becomes tomorrow's sensational headline, before we connect the dots. Dark humor aside, it's almost tragically funny how little we've learned about predicting violence until it's already too late. Yes, law enforcement has made noticeable strides since Dahmer's days of dreadful missteps. Police now get specialized training to recognize potential serial killers, understand marginalized communities better, and approach missing persons cases with far more seriousness than the casual shrugs of the late 80s. Departments across the U.S. and worldwide have implemented sensitivity training, created community liaison positions, and installed technology that helps track and connect patterns of crime faster. Surely today's officer would be quicker to see a problem than those Milwaukee officers who unwittingly handed young Conorak synthesomphone back to Dahmer, right? Perhaps. But if recent history is any guide, bias and apathy remain stubbornly resistant to training manuals. Databases and digital footprints might make it harder to hide the kinds of horrors Dahmer got away with, but these tools are useless if nobody bothers to look closely enough. Society's fascination with true crime, the binge-watching, the endless podcasts, Guilty as Charged, and Netflix marathons, is another peculiar double-edged sword. On one hand, these shows and documentaries bring vital attention to issues like mental health, police biases, and the often overlooked victims. On the other hand, they risk turning tragedy into entertainment, softening us into passive observers rather than active participants in prevention. Sure, we know every chilling detail of Dahmer's apartment decor better than we know our own neighbor's favorite ice cream flavor. But does knowing every gruesome fact help us notice if someone next door is struggling or someone down the street is missing? Maybe not. Perhaps our binge-watching has simply desensitized us further, numbing our natural instincts to intervene or reach out. And then there are those awkward societal biases we don't like to admit are still here, We claim loudly that we've evolved, that we understand diversity better, that we'd never again dismiss missing young men as runaways or people living risky lifestyles. But again, reality gently disagrees. Just a few years ago, Bruce MacArthur preyed on Toronto's LGBTQ community, killing multiple men over nearly a decade while police repeatedly denied a serial killer was operating in their city. It was deja vu all over again, complete with missed signs, ignored community voices, and authorities reassuring themselves and the public that everything was just fine until body parts were discovered buried in planters. Dahmer, Port, MacArthur, different names, different eras, disturbingly similar outcomes. All cases wrapped in red tape, sealed with indifference. Even as authorities adopt new protocols, even as we continually evolve our attitudes toward sexuality and race, blind spots linger stubbornly in our collective consciousness. Just as it happened in Milwaukee decades ago, those from marginalized groups, whether because of race, sexuality, economic status, or all of the above, still struggle to be heard, seen, and protected, with the same urgency granted to more privileged victims. For every advance in public awareness, there remain troubling blind spots, often deeply ingrained in institutions that assure us they've learned from history's mistakes until they inevitably repeat them. Ultimately, Jeffrey Dahmer's legacy is a painful reminder that real progress takes more than hindsight. It requires constant vigilance, uncomfortable honesty, and sustained attention. Yet complacency remains an easy fallback. We've learned to talk openly about mental health, but often still hesitate to act until tragedy forces our hand. We recognize biases in theory, yet they creep back into practice when least expected, in small, subtle decisions that accumulate until they're devastatingly visible in hindsight. And we become masters of recognizing monsters, after they're caught, that is. There's something almost darkly humorous about our collective reaction when tragedies inevitably recur. Society gasps in disbelief, wonders aloud, how could this have happened? And pledges solemnly, earnestly, to do better next time. And perhaps we mean it, at least we think we do, until the next Dahmer appears. Until the next overlooked loner slips through the cracks, quietly collecting his dark fantasies, patiently waiting to show us how little we've actually learned. In the end, the troubling question isn't just whether we've learned from Dahmer's story. No, the deeply unsettling thought, the thing that keeps criminologists awake at night and fuels countless late-night debates among professionals, is that despite everything, perhaps we haven't changed as much as we claim. After all the training, the textbooks, the TV specials, and hard-learned lessons, human nature remains stubbornly unchanged. We prefer comfort to discomfort, certainty to ambiguity, reassurance over alarm. In other words, despite all the progress we've made, we may still prefer to look away, hoping monsters remain safely confined to our screens and bookshelves. The terrible irony is that as long as we convince ourselves we're smarter, safer, and wiser than before, we remain vulnerable to the same mistakes that allowed Jeffrey Dahmer and those like him to operate undetected for so long. It's a bitter pill, certainly, but maybe necessary medicine for a society so certain it won't swallow it twice. Because here's the uncomfortable truth that Jeffrey Dahmer's haunting legacy leaves us with. Even after everything, even with all the textbooks, training, documentaries, and hindsight, maybe, just maybe, we haven't truly learned anything at all.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.